So a few weeks back, I gave a retreat at the monastery, a 10-day retreat or 9-day retreat, of which one of the monks had said, can you do a 9-day retreat just on the breath? And I said, well, I'll check the Guinness Book of Records and see if there's anybody who's ever done that. But so I'll give it a shot. So I gave talks, and of course I didn't know whether I really had that kind of amount of information in me. But so I managed to talk for 9 evening talks about breath meditation. For my next series, it'll be on a grain of sand. 9 talks on a grain of sand. You know the saying, you can see the whole universe in a grain of sand. Anyway, this breath is really an enormous... it's a simple thing, and yet it just keeps unfolding and unfolding. And one of the... In studying breath meditation, I've had to look through all of these different commentaries and developments and different schools and techniques. And I learned it this way. I went to, you know, a long time ago, I started with breath meditation 38 years. Yeah, I think it is. And you go to different schools. The first introduction to breath meditation was with a Tibetan lama, a Tibetan monk. And then the next one was with a Korean monk. They're from different schools, but rather similar, actually. And then to the Theravada with a Sri Lankan monk. And in the meantime, I began to... come across, you know, where the sources of where they're teaching from. So these are, of course, go right back to the time of the Buddha, and it was apparently the chosen subject of meditation on the night that he transitioned from being the Bodhisattva to being the Buddha under the Bodhi tree. And he had to somehow he had not done this before. Although, if you read the prior stories, the earlier stories, he seems to have spent 6 years with some yogis who were devoted to the higher stages of jhanic meditation. So it's hard to understand how he could not have come across breath meditation in all that time. But apparently he didn't. What he had to do was recall his childhood. And he recalled this beautiful experience of being under the Bodhi, under a tree, a rose apple tree, actually, in the spring during the plowing festival. And he was surrounded by surrounded by his family and friends, and feeling very safe and well taken care of, had not encountered any harshness or unkindness in life, and was a good little boy, apparently, and had no ill will in him, and not much in the way of greed or so forth. And anyway, he went into a kind of a state of bliss while breathing, just noticing that he's breathing. And probably when you were a child, that lying, you know, trying to go to sleep on a summer night when it's still light out and your parents put you in bed at 8:30, you know, it's you have still a little left in you. So sometimes you notice that you're breathing, and as a kid, you just pay attention to that and so forth. This is he recalled this. Now, what's important about the psychology of this is that he'd left the palace at 29 and had been seeking with other teachers for the next 6 years in very harsh conditions. They practiced extreme austerities. He had come close to starving himself to death. And he tried some very, very harsh types of practices, including holding his breath and, you know, until you pass out and all those kind of things. So why did he leave the palace? Existential anxiety. What's the meaning of life? What's the point? How do you deal with this? The nature of the inevitability of death and loss, possibilities of illness, certainty of aging. In the midst of this, how do you not remember that? So for some people, they easily forget such things and play around in the world, indulging in this and that. But he's not that type. He just can't quite forget that. And for those who do forget it, though, it still comes to them, and it's very shocking when it does, because you're not prepared at all to deal with it. And when you lose certain things that you depend on for getting through the day, then you're bereft of possibilities. You don't have any backup plan. So this is the motivation. He's in good shape. He's not mistreated or mistreating himself or anything. He just can't enjoy his life until he solves some of these deeper issues. And so then he goes off, and he falls in with the yogis who are trying to solve some similar type of problem, but they've somehow, human nature instinctively goes to a kind of a really self-punishing thing as virtuous. So a deprivation of the body is considered, you know, high discipline, and that must be a good spiritual practice. Anyway, he decides it's going nowhere after 6 years of this. And that's a moment, that's the time that he discovers the breath, and he discovers the breath because he has given up these very harsh and futile practices. And there's a moment of relief, utter relief. He's sitting now under a shady tree. Instead of out baking in the sun or sitting in a thorn bush or something, he's decided to eat, get in out of the heat, in the shade of a tree, of a kind tree, like the rose apple tree. And he's near a river, and there's a breeze blowing across the river. And so because of this, the mental state he's returned to a state of innocence, and he is experiencing great relief too, physical relief. The body is very happy that calories are coming in, the body is happy that he's in the shade, and the breeze, you can imagine, especially that breeze, that gentle breeze blowing across his face. And he makes an association. He remembers being a child and the breeze blowing. And then he remembers that as a child he went into this state of joy and some mild ecstasy of the first jhana. The first jhana is what we now have listed under the eighth factor of the Eightfold Path. There are four jhanas under that. It's called sama samadhi, the right concentration, and it's specifically given as these four jhanas, and the elements of these jhanas are also given. One of them is joy, one of them is ease of body, and applied and sustained attention to the whatever the object is, and the last one, which is given sometimes and sometimes not, but it's called ekagata, which is the mind wholeheartedly directed, or giving one's complete attention to something, one-pointed. Sometimes it's translated as, but very unfortunately, it's a little bit, makes you think of a laser beam or something, one pointed. But it's not really that. It's a complete lucid clarity, without wavering. So you're on a single object of attention without wavering, and that's the oneness. You are one in your interest, in your direction of attention, wholehearted. So he had entered this state, and so now he recalls this, and this is his way out. This is the beginning of, by the end of the evening, he'll be the Buddha. It's very interesting. Ties it back into so what is he experiencing? A sense of relief. And a trust, the kind of a childlike trust. And remember, as a child, he is well raised. He's surrounded by loving kindness. He has a sense of safety and trust. So when we do this breath meditation, we have to be like that. We also imagine ourselves either as the child or as the bodhisattva who is... Now, he's more like us because we've all been down the wrong track one way or the other and experienced frustration, exhaustion, all kinds of difficulties, problems in life. And some of them are just the way we think and what we expect of ourselves and what the kind of attitudes that we've been handed. And we think it has to be this way. And so it's painful. And so one of the hints we should take from this is that maybe sometimes it's better just to give up. Maybe it's not, if it's not working for you, just think, I have to just stop this and see if I can reset the whole process. And then he's searching around in his mind for something, and the association comes up. You know, this is like before I started having all of these responsibilities and demands upon me, what was life like? You know, maybe you have to go back to your childhood to find that. When the mind is unburdened, you're not preoccupied all the time. So this is the theme of this, and what he said, he realizes, and he says, one thing is that this is without. There's nothing. No harm will come of this. This is blameless. So you're not. You're not indulging yourself. Sometimes, like some schools of Buddhism, are very wary of blissful or pleasant states. They don't get attached. You know, everything comes and goes. Watch out. But very strangely, the Buddha himself is saying, there's no harm will come of this. This is blameless. It's a blameless abiding. And, you know, later on, after he's the Buddha, he still goes back to this, spends lots of time in this state because it's blameless. It's not a problem. It wasn't a problem before, and it wasn't a problem afterwards. But it's not the only thing. It's a way of preparing the mind so that the mind can, with utter clarity and lucidity, look at the situation of what it is to be alive and what it is, what life is about, and what are the elements that are of a danger to us that would cause us distress, and what would be the attitudes that we should look upon these things with. And that, so the insight that he had arose after the profound serenity that he experienced, because he went right into the deepest states of the jhana, right down to the fourth jhana, before turned his mind to investigation of what it is, what are the laws of human existence. So it's very instructive that, and very important that we find both the relief from frustrating types of approaches to life, the tension of life, dwelling always in the thinking part of the mind, or being swept away by extreme emotions. Neither of these are satisfactory, and we need to find a way out. And so this is the breath, and it's a very gentle and innocent. And so you have to set this up for yourself as a place of safety, a beautiful experience in and of itself, and also the great benefit that when you use your mind afterwards to reflect and to investigate, it's going to come across new ideas and new insights. But if we try to get new insights with the same stale mind that we always have, we're likely to just repeat patterns or just lose our train of thought or get bored or wander away. We can't sustain it long enough to break through to a new level, which is, you know, makes you determined to go that in that direction. So this is the great value of this breath meditation, but we need to understand it as the simplest before any kind of techniques or commentaries were developed. So what we have is the earliest story of breath meditation is this first night before he's the Buddha, remembering being a child. So it can't be that complex. A kid can do it. You know? There wasn't any... How did he do it if it was all, it's all that complex? There's a gentle breathing. So you kind of have to pretend that you're a child, you know, just sitting in a beautiful shady spot, feeling the breeze. Maybe your eyes are closed and just nothing unnatural. I mean, why would a child breathe in a special way? They're just breathing and they're just feeling them. Maybe the gentle little breath coming out the nose, or just the how cool it is when you can imagine in India, it's hot, and to be under the shade of the tree, and to when you inhale, it's nice. The air is nice and cool coming in, so very cooling. In Thailand, when I was there, some of the monks, it's very hot as well, and quite a few of the monks actually. And there's some red oil that seems to be pervasive there. It's a kind of menthol or something like that, and it's highly evaporative. And you put it on your nose, around the rim of your nose, and they call it personal air conditioner. It's because when you breathe in, it's really just chilly. You know, it's 90 degrees out there, but you're trying to cool yourself down, but when you have this on your nose, it's just like breathing in icy cool air, you know? And so this helps attention to the nose, and it's also extremely cooling, very very extreme, you know. So you can take a clue from that as well. It's a very pleasant, cool, and beautiful experience. Each inhalation, they're enhancing it by this oil. Unfortunately, it's rather addictive. And you do, after you don't stop using it, your nose starts to get sore and stuff. So, yeah, it's got its... you'll just have to do it without the oil. Although it's, you know, give it a shot if you can find something like that, you know. Maybe, what is it, Vicks Vapor Rub or something like that. So, trying to bring the spirit, the right spirit to this and nothing too technical. And there are all kinds of, later on, centuries and centuries later, they get more and more questions coming up about how do you exactly do this. But we have to keep it simple and realize it's not really about the breath, it's about the mind. You're just allowing you're going to the simplest experience of the body. It goes by itself. The breath goes by itself. It's autonomic, and we're also learning not to interfere with our consciously interfere. The breath intersects consciousness and automatic. It's right on the halfway in there. You can hold your breath, But then you can go to sleep and it'll thing breathes by itself. You know, you don't have to do anything; it just goes by itself. Or you can interfere with it if you want. But I think it's something like the world around you. Actually, the world around you just goes by itself. The weather goes by itself and everything. But every now and then we get the feeling that we're in charge, or we have some say in the matter, and we get tense. We're trying to will the world to go our way, to do what we want. We want it not to rain. You may not be very conscious of this, but you watch yourself how many times you're willing the situation to go one way or the other, and the situation is the world around you, and it's not available to your will. It's out of your control. And so learning to just watch your breath without interfering with it is also a way of learning to just be this equanimous observer of the world, because there's just nothing but stress and tension in hoping and fearing about how the world and the situation around you will or will not go. And this is one of the things you can learn from watching the breath, is you can teach yourself that you don't have to consciously breathe. It happens by itself, and you can watch it. But as soon as you start watching it, you start changing, you know, you start interfering with your breathing mechanism. So this is a kind of training. He's choosing this in a very specific ways. Like, it's available to you all the time. You can just, can you step into the observer's position? In the Thai forest tradition, they have a saying, which is the one who knows. And they talk about this one who knows. And what that one who knows is what we would call pure objective and detached observation. Your consciousness, there's something back there that knows and sees. It just knows. And they're asking you to sort of go up the stream of your experience to that place, that one who knows. It doesn't have a name. It's the impersonal you. It's that which knows. You know, we personalize everything. We got this personality, this name, and all this kind of stuff. But these are impersonal processes. There's this knowing, this consciousness is impersonal, and it's detached from the all of the information that's coming into it. So they're asking you to practice going up to the one who knows. I think in English we would be like a kind of a psychologist who is trying to be objective and not interfere, or an anthropologist or something like this. It's like, can you observe, but please don't judge, don't interfere, observe. And in order to do that, you have to go upstream into the more just the pure consciousness position. So this helps you detach from you have a strong investment, there's lots of tension, and you want certain things to cease, and you want certain things to continue. Not to get what you want is to suffer. To get what you do not want is to suffer. So these are the first noble truth of suffering. This is what we do to make ourselves suffer. And we do that because we haven't discovered the vantage point of pure equanimity. Equanimity, by the way, is found in a lot of different places. It's found in pure wisdom. It's one of what do we call the perfections of virtue. It's a virtue, a perfection of wisdom, personality, to be balanced. And it's also the dominant characteristic of the deepest states of concentration. In the deep fourth jhana is characterized by pure equanimity. So this equanimity, we're trying to cultivate it in many ways, consciously, as we move through life, even in the midst of conversations, and we're aware of the balance. Are we how's the balance? And then when we don't have to deal with the world, when we close our eyes and go to the breath, we also can experience this. How's the balance of things? And if we're not balanced, the meditation will tell you. It will tell you. You'll see how you drift, how you're pulled this way and that way. Can't pay attention. It means the balance is not there. So that's also the nature of samadhi. The word samadhi, first two syllables, sama, meaning balanced. We often think of it as concentrated, but it actually means balanced. Maybe the word concentrated, if we just remove the center from that, so it's centered. You're centered, balanced. And so this is the essence of this. Relaxed, lucid, balanced. So this is some hints and clues for breath meditation. When you go off and practice on your own, you remember this story, you know, about this. It is simple and innocent, like a child. And to use that also as a sense of relief, the Buddha is giving up just the harsh impositions as an adult that he's imposed on himself. He's been a good student. He's listened to these guys, and it's all been bad advice. Happens all the time. So he just says, you know, enough of this. It just can't be that way. It's got to be. There is a blameless way to live, and it's innocent, and it's without pain. So last night I gave a talk on how to make a cup of tea, and some of you were here for that, right? And it was about discovering that I had been making green tea the wrong way for 20 years. So anyway, we're at a little restaurant today, a Japanese restaurant, where this is the third anniversary of our visit to this Japanese restaurant, so they have good tea. And I mentioned to the guy that was offering it that I was on a tour talking about how to make a cup of tea. So he was came back with the recipe from his restaurant. Put it on the table. So let me read it to you. It's very interesting. Matsuki An's green tea brewing instructions. Our green tea is a mix of tea leaves, genmai, which is brown rice, and matcha, green tea powder. First, bring water to a boil and let it cool for approximately 5 minutes. Wow. It's best at about 85 degrees centigrade. Not 100 degrees centigrade, 85 degrees. If the water is too hot or too cold, the leaves will not fully open. Use a fine tea strainer and measure about 1 tablespoon of tea leaves for a cup of tea. So get your quantities right. But feel free to add or reduce to suit your taste. Pour the hot water over the tea leaves and do not steep. Steeping will cause the tea to lose the beautiful green color of the matcha and make it taste bitter. Four, enjoy. Tastes best if tea leaves are used only once. That's simple. It's delicious. But how easy it is to go pour boiling water on that for 20 years and steep it. Yeah, well, don't you steep tea? No, not that one. So, you know, there's so many instructions, all kinds of things in life just need a little bit of a rethinking. There's just so many parts of a life. So if you're not making your life a good cup of tea, if it's bitter, just go over the instructions one more time about how hot you're cranking your life up to be and how long you're steeping in some old injury or insult or some old problem, you know, remove yourself, remove that thing. It's, you're steeping in it. And then you might get yourself a nice cup of tea, a nice life. Enjoy. So, now it is time for Q&A, if you like. I'll open that. Yes.